Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, June 16th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. Cherry, the word tip to mean gratuity.
Yes.
Do you know its origins?
No, I do not.
So legend has it.
Oh, legends.
Well, legend in this case is I read it in the New Yorker.
Okay.
Legend has it that the word tip is actually an acronym. So back in the day in English coffee houses, they would inscribe on urns that you would leave a tip in to ensure promptitude.
Wow.
And that got shortened to tip. And now tipping is everywhere. From those humble beginnings, especially in this country.
Yes,
we're a big tip culture, as you know.
Culture.
And with the World Cup coming to Philadelphia, a lot of businesses have decided to add an auto gratuity because elsewhere in the world, they're not used to tipping service workers as much as we tip service workers. And service workers here are very much dependent on tips because the wages they make otherwise are in the basement. So today we're going to talk about tipping culture, how we got here in America, whether this is a healthy place to be, and how tipping culture has evolved, especially in the swivel tablet era. We have questions for you. How do you feel about tipping? Do you think tipping culture in America is working, or do norms in the service industry need an overhaul? Our number is 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
Yeah, a lot of people have been commenting on my Facebook page today about this. People have strong feelings
about tipping.
Yes. A lot of people don't like it. And you talked about that swivel, you
tablet.
Know, tablet. Oh, my gosh. And people kind of staring at you as you type in your amount.
Called the guilt swivel right there.
Oh, my goodness. I look forward to hearing from you again. Our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And we have our trio of local news stories. The big story, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has ruled that the unlicensed skills games that have been operating in gas stations, convenience stores, and other small businesses across Pennsylvania, well, now they are illegal under the Gaming Control Act. Mm. And this is a pretty big deal because it impacts 70,000 machines throughout the state. You know the machines, Texas Poker, Gin Rummy, there are a couple of examples.
Yeah.
Well, lower courts had originally ruled that these games required more skill than luck, and therefore they fell outside of the state's gambling laws, and this allowed small businesses to basically operate with no oversight. But the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned those rulings. They decided instead that these machines are basically slot machines and must be regulated under state law. Now, to slow the burn and so people won't, you know, be up in arms, the high court has barred law enforcement from seizing the machines for 120 days to give lawmakers a chance to come up with a regulation scheme. The Independent Fiscal Office, they estimate that Pennsylvania could bring in about $1 billion every single year if the revenue on these machines are taxed. And the big question is, will the legislature act? Avi, as you know, we've been talking about budget season every single year on the show.
Yep.
And the issue
Crunch
of skills
time.
Games
yeah.
kept coming up. And every year they would kick it down the road. Right now, you know, kick the can down the road, should I say. Right now, the governor has proposed a 52% tax on these, but Republicans say 16%. So
yeah.
there's a big cavern there. But the high court says 120 days.
Do something.
Yeah.
Do something. And like you said, one of the reasons we're giving this story so much attention at the top of the show is because it's very much tied up in these ongoing budget negotiations and has been for several cycles now. They haven't been able to figure it out. This would seem like the push they need to figure something out.
The pressure is on. The pressure is on. I mean, we could rock, paper, scissors this thing and see what's going to happen. I don't know. But, you know, I mean, clearly somewhere between 52 and 16%.
There are numbers between those.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But like you've mentioned this before, like oftentimes it does take the judicial branch to prod the legislative branch and the executive branch to like,
and you were we were listing examples.
Yeah, education funding was another example in Pennsylvania. So, yeah, you know, I don't know if the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania likes to be in this position of having to step in and do this, but here they are.
Yeah.
Story number two, look, we're going to talk a lot about the restaurant industry today on the show. Some of it not so flattering. So let's take a moment to highlight some positive examples of what's happening in the industry here in Philadelphia. The annual James Beard Awards ceremony took place last night in Chicago. It's basically the Oscars of food. And two Philly spots won big. Let's start with Kalea. The groundbreaking Thai restaurant started in South Philly, moved to Fishtown. It won Most Outstanding Restaurant in America.
Yes.
Full stop.
Amazing.
That's the same prize that a local restaurant called Friday, Saturday, Sunday took home in 2023. Zahav won it in 2019. Before that, I'm not sure actually any Philly restaurant had ever won it. So we've clearly been picking up the pace in recent years.
Big deal.
Also, Chef Jesse Ito won Best Chef in the Mid-Atlantic region. This was his ninth nomination and first win. He's like the Susan Lucci of chefs.
So
congratulations to Jesse Ito. Very, very, very well deserved. He runs Royal Sushi in Izakaya in Queen Village. And it gets the Avi Beard Award because it's one of my favorite restaurants in the whole city. Just a great spot.
Yeah.
So just, again, general affirmation that the Philly food scene has truly established itself as the elite of the elite.
I love it. And I'm so excited because I'm finally going to Kalea.
Yes.
We've had reservations.
Never been.
Never been. And we've had reservations for later this week for like weeks.
Oh, wow.
And it just
happens
that this happened. So I'm super excited. But it also made me wonder, you know, how Philadelphia has become this magnet for top culinary talent.
Yeah, well,
and we have attracted some really great people, and the city recently was donned the new Cradle of Culinary. Okay.
Oh, wow.
I was like, okay. And that's according to Visit Philly, and they said that we've become this one-stop chef-driven spot for like passion projects. And I remember we had Nook Santaranan on the show, and she talked about how Kalea was her passion project, and she was just serving people like it was almost at her house, and people just flocked to her. And now look at her.
Oh yeah, totally.
James Beard.
And I think to answer your question, I think one of the explanations is that the startup costs here are lower than in places like New York and LA, and so a lot of
a
lot of really creative people with a lot to express in their food might not have had the money to get a foothold in one of these bigger markets. They come to Philly, or they're able to at least get started in Philly and do some really cool stuff.
And then they have a lot of hungry people here.
you know, I'm hungry all day, every day. By the way, bring me some leftovers from Kalea.
I will. Our third story for today, an unlikely international rock star is planning to make his stage debut right here in Philadelphia. Dionysios Tabakis is a 53-year-old priest living in Greece. And there he is. If you're watching on YouTube, he has a long, white, flowing beard, and he has this long, black, flowing robe. And Father Tabakis has never played a live concert. Instead, he has spent a lot of time playing his electric guitar at home, and the man has gotten really, really, really good. He started a YouTube channel. He grew his subscribers. He's gotten thousands of views. And well, recently, Father Tabakis released his debut album. It's called Paradise Metal. It mixes Greek liturgical music with more modern sounds. And by the way, I want you to take a look, listen. Rock out, Father. By the way, he dropped 150 hard copies. It blew up on music blogs. It went wild on social media. And I have to say, the man has soul.
Oh, yeah. Big time soul.
Oh, my God. I mean, if you listen to some of his music, it sounds like blues. Other music sounds like metal.
Yeah.
Other music is like chants.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, so many stories out there where it's like internet bad, but this is one of those stories where it's like internet good sometimes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like this guy like is just doing his thing, living in Greece, being a priest. He's, you know, in his 50s, and all of a sudden the internet discovers him, and now he's going to play a live show for the first time ever here in Philadelphia. So first, let me say to Philly, let's support this guy. Show this guy some love. Father Tabakis, he's only ever played for his wife before.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to come to this music festival in Philadelphia, a big music festival called Making Time, and make his stage debut. So I really hope it goes well.
And shout out to the New York Times for this write-up. And, you know, all I can say is it's never too late. And for our
never
religious folk, Won't he do it?
Yeah. This guy went from Slayer to Prayer.
Oh, that's so good.
From Judas Priest to Just Priest.
Oh, my goodness.
They call him Black Robe Sabbath.
I know that's right.
Because he's been taking back Sunday since before y'all were born.
And he rocks out. I mean, he rocks out, but he does it in such a holy way. It's like he's just so calm in his rock outs.
Father Tabakas, come see him in Philadelphia. I think it's September, right?
September, right here in Philadelphia.
I call him Father T.
His debut performance. And I think the place is going to be filled.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Will they be tipping the people that serve them drinks at this festival?
Yeah, well, we'll see. They'll probably pass the church plate around. That's what Father Tabakas can do.
That's a different type of tipping. Yeah. We're going to talk about tipping culture in America on the other side of this break. You are listening to Studio 2. By the way, get your thoughts in. Comments already rolling in. Studio 2 at WHYY.org, 888-477-9499.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, the World Cup has invited travelers from all over the world to good old Philadelphia. And one adjustment they'll need to make is to American tipping culture.
Yeah, knowing that many tourists might not be familiar with our norms, some restaurants in host cities like Philly are scrapping the usual tip line in favor of a 20% service fee, a move that underscores just how crucial tips are to American restaurant workers.
While tourists may be caught off guard, locals might be relieved not to be asked to tip even more. Nowadays, it seems like everywhere you go has a tip screen trying to guilt trip you.
Oh, yeah. So today we're talking about tipping in the U.S., why consumers are sick of it, and why many workers can't get by without it. And we've invited two great guests to the table to talk about it. We have Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at University of California, Berkeley. Saru, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Kate Lamberton, professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Kate, welcome back to Studio 2.
Nice to see you.
And we're asking you this hour, how do you feel about tipping? Do you think tipping culture in America is working? Or do norms in the service industry need an overhaul? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2 at whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Drop a comment in the live chat.
And Saru, we wanted to start with you. For people who don't understand the American system, can you explain why tips aren't really, quote, extra income for many workers?
Yes. Sadly, this has a very ugly and sad history. So the restaurant industry is the largest employer of women, people of color, immigrants, youth in the United States. It's nearly 14 million workers, largest employer in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia as well, private sector employer. But it is the absolute lowest paying, and it has been for generations, dating all the way back to emancipation when the wage structure was created. So prior to emancipation, waiters in the U.S. got actual full wages. There were no tips. Tipping was not prevalent at the time. Around the 1850s, tipping started to come from Europe, where it had originated as an extra or bonus that aristocrats gave to servants, but always on top of a wage. Now, when it came, right around that time, emancipation happened, and restaurants after emancipation hit upon the idea of saying to newly freed Black people, Black women in particular, we're not going to pay you at all. We're going to continue accessing free labor by telling you, you don't get a wage. You're going to live on this new thing that's come from Europe called a tip. Now, it's important to understand that that was the first time in world history that tipping was mutated from an extra or bonus on top of a wage, as it had been for generations in Europe, to becoming the entirety of a person's wage. And it's why after that, in 1938, as part of the New Deal, when everybody else got the right to a federal minimum wage, restaurant workers were excluded and told, you get nothing, you get only tips. And we went from a $0 wage in 1938 all the way up to the absurd and ridiculous $2.13 an hour, the current federal minimum wage for tipped workers. And sadly, Pennsylvania is not much higher at $2.83, which means that that wage is so low, it goes entirely to taxes for nearly all workers, which means that most workers are relying entirely on their tips to survive, to pay their rent, to feed their children. And I have to tell you that That is not a stable income. Tips go up and down. They fluctuate month to month, season to season, shift to shift. And your rent and your bills don't go up and down. In fact, right now, they're only going up and up. And tips have unfortunately stagnated with the economy. And so you're looking at a workforce that is still overwhelmingly women and people of color relying on this very unstable income to survive.
Yeah. Marie says, it infuriates me that a vestige of Reconstruction still lives in the tipped minimum wage. If employers were to pay even the standard minimum wage, we wouldn't be expected to tip as much. No one gets wealthy doing the back-breaking work of a server. Belinda with a similar comment. The rest of the world is moving toward American habits when actually we should be moving towards the rest of the world. Employers, just pay your workers properly. Mm-hmm. So when you tip at a restaurant, just say whatever a standard restaurant is, Saru, who gets the money? Is it pooled typically? Does it go just to the server? Does the host get some? What's the typical breakdown when you leave your 20%?
So it's never the case that when you tip, people are just keeping it. One server is just keeping it. Instead, what's happening is that when you tip, that those tips are going to a whole group of workers who share it, servers, bussers, runners. Some restaurants illegally share with the back of the house. Now, if everybody were paid a full minimum wage, as we've been fighting for, not just a minimum wage, but frankly, a living wage with tips on top, then it might be okay that your tips are shared among a lot of people. But
and just to clarify, the back of the house, those are like the cooks.
Kitchen staff.
Right. Okay.
And that's illegal as long as you're paying workers this sub-minimum wage of $2.83. You are not supposed to be sharing tips with the kitchen staff, who get a full minimum wage. If everybody were getting a living wage, right? And honestly, right now, the MIT living wage calculator says that a person in Philadelphia, if they have any kind of dependent, needs more than $25 an hour with tips on top. That's what we're fighting for, is a living wage with tips on top. But without that, $2.83, the servers rely entirely on those tips that they are then sharing with so many other workers, you know, front of house, dining workers, dining staff workers. And so it's very little. And what happens when you are so reliant on these unstable tips? Well, I can tell you the data shows tipped workers have the highest rates of sexual harassment and racial inequities of any industry in the United States. And that is because you have a mostly female workforce working as servers, putting up with the most inappropriate behavior from customers in order to get those tips to feed their families.
And Saru, before I bring Kate into the conversation, I just wanted to get your reaction to this move that many restaurants and host cities like Philadelphia have, you know, decided to go ahead and just charge a 20% service fee to, you know, anyone who comes to their restaurant to sort of deal with this influx of tourists coming in. Your thoughts on that, your reaction to that decision?
Yeah, I mean, if we keep the current system, it is absolutely necessary to ensure that workers get some kind of gratuities to feed their families. But this is not the real solution. The real solution is not to guarantee everybody gets tipped and allow employers to still pay $2.83. The real solution is to have employers, as your guest wrote in, pay a living wage to their workers so that they can survive. Like every other employer has to pay the minimum wage, make restaurants do the same, and let gratuities be on top of that so that workers are not so reliant on varying populations, varying days, varying shifts, and again, an economy in which we're experiencing generalized tip fatigue. Tips are generally going down because the economy is so tough. And so people should not have to rely on that or a service charge. They should get a full wage with gratuities on top, whether that's a service charge or tips. Mm.
And Catherine on YouTube says, I always tip 18 to 20% regardless of service quality. As a former service worker, I understand that servers earn little without tips. I am the mindset that if you can't afford the tip, don't go out. A lot of people on Facebook commenting, depending on how I felt about the service. Delilah says, if there's a service fee, then I may not tip. The service fee will then be the tip. And so Kate, wanted to bring you into the conversation. How do people generally feel about tipping? Because I think a lot of folks don't really know all that Saru just talked about, that there's this $2, less than $3 an hour minimum wage that people are getting. they don't, they're very like based on, you know, how the service was and all this. They don't really understand that. What have you found as far as what people think about tips in America, how they view them?
So it's really a complicated situation when you take into account the psychology of the customer. You had Catherine who just wrote in, you read what she said. She's very self-aware in the sense that she's saying, I always give this amount regardless mm-hmm. of the service. What the research shows is that although most people will say that they tip based on service quality, that explains only about 4% of variance in tips, which creates an even harder situation for the servers because they're sort of socialized to believe that if they give great service, they're going to give great tips. And of course, then the restaurant owners can say you're not getting great tips because you're obviously not giving great service. But that's not really the case.
So what does explain variance then?
Well, a lot of it has to do with our own internal sense of what makes us a good person, right? This is about signaling to myself and another person that I'm generous. Some of us feel more of a need to do that than others. The U.S. is a huge outlier in terms of tipping culture. 70% of the world has a low or no tipping culture because they pay their servers in a different way. But in the U.S., the explanation is that our very high level of individualism and our high level of sensitivity to status both feed our tipping culture, meaning when I tip, I want to prove to myself and others that I have the resources to do so. And we feel that individuals should have to earn every single thing that they get. In other cultures, a role like being a server is something where people take the pride in their job, for example, in Japan, says that if you tip them, you're actually insulting them because it is our collective duty to create a good experience. And to pay them suggests that either you think their employer is lousy or you think they have to be bribed to do it. So in the U.S., I think, you know, in general, the more individualistic a culture is, the higher the power distance in the culture, the importance of status, the bigger the tendency to rely on tips.
We're asking you this hour, how do you feel about tipping? Do you think tipping culture in America is working? Do norms in the industry need to change, need an overhaul? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Drop a comment in the live chat. Ian is a 16-year Philly service industry veteran, wrote in and said, one thing many folks don't realize is that servers have to tip out their bartenders, bussers, and food runners. Typically, it's 3 to 5% of beverage sales to the bar, 3 to 5% food sales to the food runners and bussers. 20% tip feels like a lot to a consumer, but the server is making less than $3 an hour and is tipping out support staff based on your bill, regardless of how much or whether you tip. Let me ask you another question here, Kate. So you say that psychologically a lot of what drives the individual's tip, whether it ends up being 10, 15, 20, 25%, is about them and sort of it sounded like you're saying their sense of maybe even guilt or how they view themselves status-wise. Is that part of it also, do you think, like unique to the American mindset, or do you think that also explains whatever gratuity is added for a customer in other countries, even ones that are not as like tip reliant?
In other cultures, there are other reasons. So for example, in Europe, if you've traveled there recently, there's sort of an idea that you kind of round up, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You just round up because it's easier and it's sort of absurd to stop and, you know, quibble over a tiny little amount in change. So it's normative. Unless there's a real problem, you just round up. That's a different reason in a lot of ways. In other cultures, there is, for example, in places like Morocco, there's a longstanding tradition of always adding a little extra on top. It's just a tradition. It's a thing you do that you're trained to do as a norm.
Yeah.
That's how business works,
right?
That you help communities.
It's not as much about
It's about building
you.
A relationship.
Yeah. Okay.
And in those cultures, that's a sign that you care about this relationship and that you, you know, expect to get good service in the future. So, I mean, there are other reasons in the U.S. too. For example, that people say that they want to give good tips in a location where they expect to return again because they think they'll get better service in the future. That also doesn't explain a ton of variance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think a lot of the reasons that we give ourselves make it seem like it's a logical choice, but at the end of the day, it is more of an identity-related or emotional choice, which could be why the person that wrote in that, you know, lays out the 5% that needs to go to everybody else. When a person is making that decision, they just aren't going to think that hard about that. They may even cognitively know that this tip is being split up, But in that moment, it's really a sort of a gut response more than anything else.
Yeah. By the way, how are you feeling about tipping? Do you think tipping culture in America is working, or do norms in the service industry need an overhaul? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook listeners and viewers, you can leave your comments in the live chat. I want to bring in a caller. We have Daniel McLaughlin, who owns Mission Taqueria, and they're on the line. Daniel, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
This has been a very live conversation, especially for Mission. We were just in the Inquirer and in the Washington Post and Food and Wine about implementing a service charge during the World Cup. And I agree with your guest about, you know, paying a living wage, and we would love to do that. But I think just we are so steeped in this tradition that is, you know, a negative tradition, one that's rooted in slavery and is kind of gross. But it just seems to be the system that we're stuck with. And, you know, our servers, including tips, make between $25 and $45 an hour. But if we internalize that rate into menu pricing, I just don't think the market would bear it. I don't think customers would come out. I think it would deter business and would ultimately affect those tipped employees' pockets. So I guess my question is like, what does real implementation look like? Like, I think this is more of a systemic change that is required at the policy level. That doesn't seem to be a priority for local, state, or federal governments at the moment.
And I'm going to ask your question, what does real systemic change look like? Can we put a pin in that? I wanted to ask Daniel a quick follow-up. How did they feel about tipping? Did they feel like they made enough money? Did they want... You know, when you tried to do the service model, were they upset about that? What was the reaction when you guys tried to roll that out from the servers themselves?
So we do have an interesting case study at our restaurant because we've been a pooled house for 10 years that we've been in business. So we have a lot of data around tipping percentages. And with or without the service charge, honestly, without the service charge, servers received more than the 20% that was listed on the bill when we did include it. So that's like an interesting psychological thing that your guests have also spoken to. There's a certain psychology around it being forced, the guests being forced to pay it, that created more friction. So it was hard to do away with once we decided to remove it, but I think our service team is more relieved to not have to have that friction table side, and that they've seen their numbers go up because psychologically there's a difference in people electing to leave the tip instead of being forced to do so.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Daniel McLaughlin. Saru, I would love to get your reaction to Daniel's observation when they rolled out this service fee experiment there, and then talk about solutions, because it doesn't seem like it might not be as easy as one might think to just, you know, give people wages when they make more with tips. Your thoughts?
It's certainly it would be hard for any employer to do this on their own. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more with that, which is why I also couldn't agree more with your guess that this is about policy change. And that is exactly what we have been working on, is policy change so that, frankly, everybody pays a minimum wage at least with the tips on top. And in the states that have already done this, we've seen tipping is higher. So there are 7 states plus multiple localities that have already done this: California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska. Most recently, DC started to go up to the full minimum wage for tipped workers. New York has gone way farther than Pennsylvania. They're at 11 or 12 right now with tips on top in New York City. And Chicago has passed a full minimum wage, moving to a full minimum wage with tips on top, as has Flagstaff, Arizona. And in each of these instances, what we've seen, whether they've gone all the way there, like the 7 states I mentioned, or they're on their way, like the cities I mentioned, in every case, we are seeing actually tipping is higher with tips on top. Small business growth rates are higher. Actually, California has twice the small business growth rate as states that have a sub-minimum wage.
And Saru, I just want to clarify that in these cases, there's no service charge to consumers. This is behind the people, the workers just get higher wages there, right?
So the service charge is a choice the restaurant makes as to how they want to do gratuities. And it's always on top of a wage in these states. So what's different from California to Pennsylvania is not service charge versus tips. That's a choice the employer makes. It's how people are paid. It's whether they get a $2.83 wage or the full minimum wage, whatever it is in that state. And then it could be a service charge or tips on top, up to the discretion of the employer. What I'm saying is the states that have systematically required everybody to pay a full minimum wage with tips on top, we see higher tipping, higher small business growth rates, higher overall restaurant industry growth rates. And you don't have to take it from me. Even the CFO of Denny's admitted in a shareholder call that paying workers a full minimum wage with tips on top resulted in higher tips and overall better growth in the company. Why? Because restaurant workers are such a huge workforce. They're not just workers, they're consumers. And when they get paid more, guess what they do? They eat out more than any other workers in any other industry. And by the way, I want all of your audience members to know, who are the best tippers in the United States? Who are the best tippers? Yeah. It's restaurant workers. It's service workers. They know what it's like to work in the industry. And when they get paid an actual wage with tips on top, they're out there eating out and tipping more.
So let me
and
ask
so
you.
That's why the states that do this do better.
So let me ask you about those examples, Saru. So in these states, restaurants, the restaurant itself, the employer pays the staff more because they have to pay the staff more.
It's, they pay the staff like every other employer right. in every other industry, the minimum
right.
wage.
Right. So they pay more than restaurants in other states is what I mean. And
yes.
That cost that they're absorbing, is that reflected in the price of food? Like, what happens to that? Because they're obviously spending more money to run their restaurants vis-a-vis the people who run restaurants in other states. Can they just absorb that cost? Do they charge more for the food? What happens?
So what we're seeing is maybe at most, because the thing is that raising wages is not a dollar for dollar impact on the consumer. Every worker, even if the employer passes on 100% of the cost to the consumer, every worker serves a lot of customers.
Sure.
So there's never an instance where you raise a wage a dollar and the price goes up a dollar. That's not the way it is. What we're seeing, price elasticity is at most 9 to 10% over the period of a wage increase. So wages are never increased immediately from 2 to let's say 15 or higher overnight. All of these policies we're talking about raise wages over a very long period of time.
Yeah.
And during that period of time, you might see at most a 9 to 10% price increase. And what we're hearing from customers and from workers is prices have already gone up. Prices have gone way up in restaurants and frankly across the board. Wages have not kept up with the cost of living anywhere in Philadelphia or anywhere in the United States.
Yeah, let's bring in another caller before we go to break. We have Sherry from Hamilton, New Jersey on the line. Sherry, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So I used to manage two different Starbucks locations. One was in a blue-collar neighborhood. The other one was in a very affluent neighborhood in Princeton, New Jersey. And what I found was the tips that my staff made were very much higher in the blue-collar neighborhood than it was the affluent, probably three times more. And I found that usually it was because the people in the blue-collar neighborhood understood the value of tips, and so they tipped more. And the staff in the affluent neighborhood, we, you know, dealt with a lot of pushback. People wouldn't tip. They were nastier.
Wow.
It was just really interesting to me.
Wow.
So that's it.
Sherry from Hamilton, New Jersey.
That was eye-opening.
I know.
Okay, so let me read a couple more comments as we get ready to go to break. And we're going to talk on the other side of this break a little bit about tipping in other service and service adjacent industries, mm-hmm. not just restaurant. But Stan says, if restaurants start charging everyone a service fee, I'm going to eat out less. Michael says, I always tip at least 18% when dining out. Alana says, two situations I'd love to know about. Should I tip when I pick up takeout from a mm-hmm. restaurant? And should I tip at fast coffee / pastry shops? The latter especially frustrates me. So we're going to talk about all that on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. Hey And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're talking about tipping culture in the U.S., why we do it, why some people hate it, and why so many rely on it.
Joining us to dig into all of this are Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, as well as Kate Lamberton, professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and thank you for everybody who's been writing in. We would love, of course, to hear from you, our listeners. How are you feeling about tipping? Do you think tipping culture in America is working, or do norms in the service industry need an overhaul? The number to call is 888-477-949. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And hello to our YouTube and Facebook viewers. You can keep those comments coming in the live chat.
Before I bring in a caller, Brian, Kate, you were talking about off air about some of the stuff that Saru was saying, saying you're not surprised that people tip just as much or more when the servers get more money per hour. And you weren't surprised that the prices don't rise all that much in terms of how much you pay for food. I'm just curious if you could lay that out for our listeners.
Yeah, I think that what Saru said is really powerful, in part because it draws attention to the fact that people don't like their tip to be making up for what they feel the employer should be doing.
Yeah,
that's a
I
very
feel like
strong
I'm being
feedback.
Taken advantage of there.
So, for example, there was a period where there was this idea that they're going to add they're going to explain what the service fee is for, but then it would say things like, "This goes to pay for health care for our workers," and people thought, "Well, I want to support that, but I'm also not sure that's my job."
Right.
Right? I think that's your job. So when I know that the employer is at least paying a minimum wage, I feel like I'm giving something above that. It's much more satisfying. Mm. Whereas the service fee gives me no signal that I'm generous whatsoever. And some research I did in the past on job quality, generally there's less turnover when people have a stable wage that they can count on. Otherwise, they're gonna feel they need to move from place to place.
And there is a cost to training and hiring employees. So if you can eliminate some of that cost, that might make up some of the
You know, to the individual who wrote about the different Starbucks, servers share information about where the tips are good. And so if that's what you're relying on, it is absolutely rational to keep moving.
Mm-hmm. And quick follow-up from that caller talking about blue collar versus more affluent area. Any idea as to why there's a difference in, you know, you getting lower tips in the more affluent areas and higher tips in the blue collar?
I mean, it's very easy to rely on stereotypes for this one. But I think, as they said, when one can empathize, they're more motivated to give. There's also a reciprocity drive behind tipping that it's a little quirky, because the truth is, if we just give tips because we expect to get something back in return, it doesn't really make sense, because we often won't see the same service provider. Mm. But if we can see ourselves in the service provider and we tip, we do get a sense that we are part of a community, right? Mm. That we are part of a system that makes some kind of sense. So it does make sense. If I can't empathize with the server, it's a little bit bigger of an ask.
Yeah, I want to bring a caller, but Sarah, real quick, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in because related to that, there's just overwhelming data, sadly, that tipping is actually very much correlated with the race and gender of the server. And so to that point of, do I identify with the server? Unfortunately, our biases, our racial and gender biases as customers, which are often internalized, do show up in the data. A Black woman will always earn less in tips than a white man, even if she provides what's called perfect service. A woman will get more tips if she allows herself to be touched, if she has bigger breasts, if her hair color and eye color are a certain way. There was so much study, I'm sure you've heard about it, that women made more money in tips if they wore pigtails. It was an infantilization of these women who are very sexualized as servers. And sadly, during the pandemic, we saw this really in a very ugly way, because we heard from thousands of women, I'm regularly asked, take off your mask so I can see how cute you are before I decide how much to tip you. We heard that so often, we ended up calling it masculine harassment. Because so many women, it made it so clear that women were not tipped based on the quality of their service, but rather the judgment of the customer on their appearance. And that unfortunately plays out with race and gender differences in terms of tipping.
Wow. Kenneth says, personally, I don't like tipping, although I try to tip generously. Many years ago, when we visited Australia, we were told not to tip. We were told servers were paid very generously, and the prices on the menus reflected that. Let's bring in a caller. This is Brian from Jackson, New Jersey, who I believe has worked in the industry. Brian, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Good afternoon. My comment is, I spent about 25 years in the restaurant industry, first in the back of the house operations on the line. I studied culinary arts. And then about 5 years in, I was actually handpicked by manager because he saw how engaging I was with guests as they walked in talking about food. He said, I think you'd be great on the floor. I was scared to death. Anyways, fast forward, I made the transition. I spent 20 years in front of the house operations working at the lowest bottom position and worked my way up because I applied myself. I gained knowledge, not only from past studies, but on the current menu, and I use that knowledge to upsell. Serving is a sales position. And as I told your screener, I says, unfortunately, nowadays, servers, you walk in, they say, hi, what do you want to drink? What do you want to order? They give you a bill, and they want 20%. That's not doing it. That's an order taker. McDonald's has customers. When you go into a restaurant, you're a guest. That's how you have to treat them. You're a guest in the house, and you have to engage with them and create a memorable experience.
And I assume, Brian, you were tipped well, yes?
You know what? I refused to ever work in a restaurant where there was a service charge included because I trusted my own instinct and my hospitality background to live off of a living wage. And I worked in New York City. Now, what the restaurants do in New York City, you're not getting the full minimum wage, whatever it is in New York City. I forget what it is now. The restaurants are allowed to take something called a tip credit to help alleviate that full wage. So we were making $10 an hour in our paychecks in New York City. The reason why they are allowed to pay you a lower wage is because sometimes you walk into a kitchen, it's a 100-seat kitchen. You may only have five chefs in the kitchen, $20, $25 an hour. But you have a lot more service staff. You have waiters, you have back waiters, you have dishwashers, you have baristas, hostess. If you paid all those people a minimum wage, every menu item would increase across the board, hands down. So to help with that, alleviate the cost of that, that's why they're able to pay you a lower wage. But I'll just make a simple point. If you don't think you can live off of wages, tips, then don't take the job. Go out for a better job then.
Okay, thank you. That's Brian from Jackson, New Jersey. I mean, clearly Brian has strong thoughts, having had many positions in the hospitality industry. I want to just read this comment from Jonathan because I want to pivot a little bit to people getting tipped outside of just restaurants. Jonathan says, I started driving with Uber earlier this year and I'm appalled at how many people don't tip despite suggestions and reminders they get from the app. Without tips, rideshare drivers can't possibly afford their expenses like gas, maintenance, cleaning, etc. On Sunday, I picked up a guy at Philadelphia International, who just returned from scuba diving in Fiji. I drove him to his luxury apartment building in Center City, and he didn't give me a dollar. And so, Kate, just wanted to sort of expand the conversation a bit and talk about other industries, because we understand restaurant workers, many servers get less than minimum wage, but no one really, you know, there's Uber drivers, there's people who do hair, there's other areas. What are areas where tipping should be part of the compensation?
Yeah, I think Uber is really tricky because people find the pricing so frustrating to begin with because the base price is very variable. It's hard to figure out where the value line is, and they don't fundamentally, I don't think people generally trust the app in terms of its pricing decisions to begin with. So when I go to the Philadelphia airport and one day it's $22 and the next day it's $56 and my tip is going to move up accordingly, it's tricky. It doesn't feel like it's going straight to the service provider. It feels like it's going to Uber, who I already am concerned maybe overcharging me. So I think there, part of the issue is distrust of the platform, that the exchange for value doesn't seem quite as direct. What is kind of interesting also, you know, you make the decision to tip before you're rated by the driver, right? And so there's no real penalty of any kind if you decide not to tip. So it's an invisible decision, as in contrast to being in a restaurant where there are other people around, and conceivably you could still be in the space when the server sees
like
whether you tipped them or not.
Dynamic, yeah.
In the Uber, you've gotten out and walked away. And so that social value of tipping and that signal value is gone. So that plays against it. When we talk about things like hairstylists, I think that's a really interesting almost generational change. I'm not sure that the younger generations have an ingrained expectation of how much they should tip stylists.
Well, let me add this Kay Hag on YouTube lays it all out. When my Amazon delivery driver arrives safely, should I tip? What about USPS? Mm-hmm. Why do I tip for a haircut but not when I get my gutters clean? The weird list of some things we tip for but not others is stupid. I'm curious, Saru, ideally, do you think it's a good thing if tip culture is sort of seeping into other industries, or do you think it's a bad thing because then people get tip fatigue and resentment, as we're seeing laid out here in some of the comments?
Yeah, absolutely the latter. So even prior to the pandemic, we started to see Apple Pay, because of the Apple Pay platform and screens, spreading tipping to many retail environments where we never tipped before. And it was really, it is really problematic because federal law allows employers to pay us what we call a subminimum wage, which your caller called a tip credit. We call it a subminimum wage. They allow them to pay that subminimum wage as long as a worker makes $30 a month, such a low number, $30 a month in tips, the employer can suddenly start paying that subminimum wage. So what we're seeing happening, particularly after the pandemic, when so many workers just walked off the job and said, I can't put up with this anymore. We saw so many different new industries introducing tipping as a incentive to get workers to come back. But really what was happening is those employers wanted to basically get the same boondoggle that the restaurant industry has had for 150 years.
So then as a consumer,
to reduce their workers' wages.
But as a consumer, then I feel like I'm in a tough place. Because do I stiff the barista? Do I stiff, X, Y, and Z, you name it. Mm-hmm. But it's a collective action problem. Like, if I do it, what's the difference?
Yes, exactly.
What I know you're not an etiquette. You're not here to give us etiquette advice, Saru, but just curious, like, how do you try to navigate that?
Yeah. If I see humans, I tip 20% always. Now we're being asked to, I see many kiosks in airports where you're asked to tip and there are no humans around.
Yes.
No humans whatsoever. And so in those instances, I'm not going to do it. But if I see humans, I am going to tip 20%. But I think
even if it leads to this broader problem of allowing.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. If that's all that we do, if all we do is say, oh, I tipped 20%, I'm a good person, thank you, that's it, then yes, we are contributing to the problem. As long as there is a subminimum wage for one industry, the restaurant industry, every employer is going to want that same exception. And so we've got to end it. And there is both federal and state law moving to end that subminimum wage for all workers.
Yeah, DT on YouTube says the issue is too many businesses are asking for tips. That's how a lot of people feel. Melissa from Huntington Valley is on the line. Melissa, you're on Studio 2. We're nearing the end of the show, but what is your question or comment, if you can state it briefly?
No, I totally get the tip fatigue. I started doing Instacart, and I realized that people do, are put off by all tipping. But when you're doing something like people's food shopping and carrying heavy things and loading and unloading, I think it's appropriate to tip, and I don't think a lot of people realize that.
Thanks, Melissa.
Can we squeeze in here Stephen from Haddonfield real quick? Stephen, we're toward the end of the hour, but you've been waiting patiently. Stephen, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I worked in the restaurant industry for 13 years, and I just wanted to call attention to kind of the equity issue of back of house getting paid an hourly wage, whereas front of house got a tipped wage. You know, back of house, they work really, really hard in a dangerous environment. Restaurant front of house is equally dangerous, but oftentimes a front of house staff member can walk out, with significant cash in their pocket, whereas the back of house is counting on a minimum wage paycheck and lack of, I don't know, there's more opportunity to make money in the front of house, and that can create resentment, especially when a lot of back of house staff are people of color and also undocumented people. So I just want to call attention to that issue.
Saru, could you respond to that real quick? And I don't know if it's the type of restaurant. Mm-hmm. It may be different types of establishments. I have heard about this tension before, though, where people feel like in the aggregate, the tipped workers make out better than the folks in the back of house who might be being exploited.
That is particularly true the more upscale the restaurant is. The more upscale a restaurant is, you see this terrible racial divide between the front and the back, as your caller mentioned, gender divide, and also income divide. Look, if in the states that require everybody to pay a full minimum wage with tips on top, tipping is shared, not 50-50, but workers can legally tip out the back of the
house.
And so we call it the full line of service, the chain of service, that everybody who touches the plate that gets to your table, you know, gets a portion of the tips. And that is a equitable system that allows front of house folks to be paid very well, a full minimum wage with the tips on top, to higher tipping than Pennsylvania, and the back of the house to get a share of the tips as well. Here's the thing, that racial segregation between front and back, that was not ordained by God. That is employers' discrimination, driving workers of color to the back and white workers to the front. You know, what we really want to see is more equity racially across the restaurant, but also more equity in terms of pay. And that involves a full living wage for all workers with tips on top. And there is policy moving both at the state and federal level to get that. So we encourage listeners to be a part of that, going to livingwageforall.org.
Well, Saru, you landed the plane perfectly there. That was the end of the show. And I appreciate your time today on the program. Saru Jeyaraman, president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Appreciate your time on Studio 2. And same to you, Kate Lamberton, professor of marketing at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Kate, it's always great to see you here in Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've had some great callers today. Thank you, everybody who called in and the folks who wrote in on Facebook and via email. We appreciate you. And we also appreciate our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.